Blog Talk Radio.
In the beginning, three dudes got together because they thought they could do a podcast about professional wrestling that would surpass all others, provide real insight, and absolutely blow people's minds. And boy, were they right.
Probably. Thanks for joining the three dudes and dudes as they bring their unique outlook to the world of professional wrestling. Now welcome the heel, George Alvarado.
We're taking over.
The mouth, Vic Vespa.
We have to document it.
And of course, your host of the Three Dudes of Doom, Sergio Barrera.
That's okay, it's our damn shows.
Now join us for tonight's episode of the Three Dudes of Doom.
Partner, led to the ring by his manager, Brother Love, weighing in at 320 pounds from Death Valley, I give you The Undertaker.
The Undertaker, the mystery partner, is now revealed.
I never heard of him.
Oh, take
holy
a
cow!
Look at the size of that ham hock! Check out them drumsticks, baby! 320 pounds looks to be 6'9", 6'10", somewhere in that neighborhood, lad. 6'10"? I don't know. It's hard to tell from here. Holy cow! And look at the look on the face. I don't... Do you think it's his coffee? Doesn't look like he's having a good time. You think he'd steal the gold out of your teeth? There's only supposed to be four members on a team. This guy makes 4.5, maybe 5. Look at them eyes. We need a little nine-nine time there, pal. Hey, Buckaroo, yeah, look at him. Yeah, he doesn't look friendly at all.
In late 1990... the Phenom, The Undertaker, was introduced to the world of the WWF, now the WWE. And in the ensuing years, he has become more than a legend, more than a myth. He has become, very simply, The Undertaker. Welcome to this week's episode of The Three Dudes of Doom. My name is Sergio Barrera, and I'm here with the other two dudes, George, Vic. Tonight, we talk about The Undertaker. Welcome to the show, guys.
Oh, yes, three dudes. Are you prepared to talk about my Undertaker?
We can stop the show right there and it would be awesome.
I totally just want to go to the WWE Network and just finish watching Paul Bearer and the Undertaker now. I'm done. I'm logging off, guys. I'm done.
Seriously, that whole opening was music to my ears. Ladies and gentlemen of the audience, just so you know, a little behind-the-scenes info about the Three Dudes of Doom. We were not privy to what was just happening, so it was just as much a surprise to us as it was to you. And I'm saying it again, that was goddamn music to my ears.
Yeah, we're totally breaking that wall down, and we're just, you know, shooting. That was like, I had a grin from like cheek to cheek. Just how awesome that was. And I was like, oh my God, I was not expecting that. That was super cool. So I'm enjoying it from the standpoint of the fan right now.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that, you know, when you look up that clip on YouTube, guys, you know, what we have here from an audio standpoint is it brings back the nostalgia. It brings back the memories. I remember watching that event much later after it happened, because this is the age of, you know, videotapes and so forth. Coliseum video is, yeah, you know, really when you, unless you were able to get the pay-per-view, you know, Survivor Series of 1990, you really weren't able to watch it at any point relatively soon after. Here we have, to this day, of course, we have the network and everything is repeatable on the same day. I remember just a few years back, if you missed a Sunday night pay-per-view, you had to wait till Tuesday to catch the replay. Point being that, mm-hmm, what's missing, you know, that gave us chills just listening to it, What's missing is the visuals, the way in which the production team for the WWF, WWE Now, they panned across the audience. And you got the announcers, you know, repartee, which in hindsight, you listen to it now and it's kind of cheesy. Look at the ham hock on that guy.
Yeah.
You know, classic Piper.
The ham hock comment. That was great.
But it was the visuals of the kids' faces that they would like focus on. If you've seen that clip before, you guys know what I'm talking about. This guy debuted, Mark Calloway, which, you know, we'll talk about more, you know, his career in a bit. But The Undertaker debuts in what at the time could have been viewed as quite the cheesy gimmick. And yet he is now, you know, a wrestler of the ages that you just cannot deny has had a career of careers and one that, you know, he's carved out for himself time and again. And so tonight what I thought we'd do, guys, is just do a little bit of walk down memory lane and bring it forward and talk about the career of a guy who I think we all agree has made an impact. That's the, you know, understatement of the night. But more so, here's a guy who made an impact or has made impacts across almost 30 years of this business. And so I think what we'll do is we'll start with the, you know, a little bit of a recollection on our part. When was your first knowledge or your first understanding that The Undertaker was a thing? You know, Vic, we'll start with you. How far back do you recall being familiar with and understanding this character of The Undertaker?
Oh, man. I was down since day one-ish, to quote the Usos. I didn't see the pay-per-view like you, because again, it's like you either knew someone who would, you know, shell out the $60 or however much it was at that time to watch it, or, you know, you waited a month or two until it showed up at the video store, you know, or if somebody had it, you know, you'd trade something to get that tape. So, you know, as soon as I got my hands on Survivor Series, and I saw that guy come out, I mean, even today, that I just love how he is so invested in that character. Like, that was the era of like gimmicky characters. Like, you had like IRS, you know, and Duke the Dumpster Drossy, you know, gimmicks based on jobs. And The Undertaker, you know, an Undertaker is technically a job. And honestly, you know, a few of those stuck around, and those were those ones who really lived the character, and no one lived The Undertaker. No one lived a gimmick better than me, Mark Calloway.
Yeah, indeed. And we'll talk about that throughout the evening here on the show. George, to you, what was your first recollection of The Undertaker and, you know, sort of your first understanding of, you know, this is someone who is, you know, well, a legend.
Yeah, no doubt. It was, I would say, you know, the time we're gonna break down like all his, you know, the moments or whatever, but I could truly say that I knew this was going somewhere around the time that he did the whole Ministry of Darkness, you know, the whole storyline angles where, you know, all his guys were goth-like, you know, the whole the Undertaker logo, and he would, hang people, I guess you can say. I don't want to use the word hang, but I guess kind of put them on the cross and then put them in the sky. It was just one of those where you look at that and you just look the way his entrance was, and you knew that this was not this wasn't another Stone Cold, this wasn't another Rock, this wasn't another even Mankind, this was his own person, this his own living, breathing center of his life, I guess you could say. But at the same time, you didn't know the difference between the guy by the name of Mark Calloway all the way to the guy by the name of Undertaker. You thought it was the same guy, but it was one of those where that's how true he was, this person. But I just remember, you know, being astonished by who this guy was, and knew that this guy was going to live forever to you know, this guy would be the ultimate dead man, I guess we can, you know, coin at this point.
Sure. He debuted on an episode of Superstars on November 19th, 1990. Ironically enough, he was introduced as Kane, the Undertaker. Mm-hmm. And so the Kane portion of the name was dropped quickly right after that. And he made his first on-camera appearance at the November 22nd Survivor Series of that year, 1990. And so, you know, in that match, it took him less than a minute to eliminate Coco Beware via mm-hmm. the Tombstone Piledriver, which was his, you know, his standard move to this day. He eliminated Dusty Rhodes, and then he himself actually didn't survive the match. He was counted out in a match that was eventually won by Teddy Biasi.
But he wasn't beaten.
Right, exactly. And we someday we'll have to talk about Teddy Biasi, because what a guy. But no, and so he began a streak of extensive wins, of course, over this was the age of jobbers, right, on Superstars and
mm-hmm.
other shows.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just built as this monster that basically was unaffected by anything that was thrown his way. That was the character. I also forgot, you know, as I was researching to put this together, I completely forgot that he actually was first managed by Brother Love. And
mm-hmm.
I remember when I went back to listen to the clip as I was preparing, I thought, holy cow, I completely forgot that that's, I mean, what a contrast. I mean, who would have thought, you know, whoever was planning this in the back, you know, what are you thinking when you go, you got to put him with Brother Love, you know? it didn't stay with me, that's for sure.
Yeah. I honestly, I think they may have been looking at it as like a contrast thing, like the whole light and dark thing, and it would kind of almost make him stand out that much more. I kind of always wondered, you know, when the Paul Bearer character, like who kind of made him eventually how did that evolve? Cause it didn't happen much longer after his, debut. And of course
right.
he was announced by Brother Love on the Brother Love show. And then we start getting into WrestleMania 7 and the Greatest Challenge and all that stuff. But I wanted to talk actually about the character itself, as you were talking about earlier, being this like unstoppable, you know, force. As a young kid who is, you know, into all things nerdery, I was into horror movies. I still am. And, you know, the comparison I always drew with The Undertaker was like the Michael Myers, like Jason type character who were just like unstoppable. And he never moved really quickly, right? He would always just kind of lumber about the ring. He could move quickly when he wanted to. And as, you know, the character progressed, he started to more. But when he was beginning, he was just that, you know, thing that just popped up behind you. And I just, you know, that just dragged me in. It was fantastic. And one of the reasons I think that first Undertaker gimmick is still to this day my favorite.
Yeah, it's the fact that a lot of people that we know and who are true, you know, why maybe I shouldn't say true fans. I mean, the fans are fans. You know, people that we know. I just received a message. Folks are listening in, and our friend Erin Guajardo comments the following. Very simply, she says, he was my favorite since I first started watching wrestling with my father and brothers as a kid. And that's the thing,
yes.
is that The Undertaker takes us back to a time where, you know, for some of us, it was the introduction of wrestling. Myself, not quite so much, a little further back, because this was 1990. But I'll tell you what, and I'm kind of sheepish admitting this, I remember when The Undertaker became a thing. I remember thinking to myself when Paul Bearer came out, I thought to myself, wait a minute, that's Percy Pringle. Like, what the heck, man? Like, I was still hanging on to kayfabe and hanging on to the notion of, I don't know what's going on. And of course we wouldn't lose that for another 7 or 8 years. But the bottom line is that I was that taken by everything, but then jolted back to reality by going, wait a minute, that's Percy Pringle, man. But, you know, what an character, you know, he brought to life in Paul Bearer, which, you know, again, it goes back to the cheesy names and so forth. just, you know, these are you couldn't ever take as desperately as they tried at times. You could never separate Paul Bearer too far from the Undertaker, no matter what the storylines were. They were always tied together. And for me, as a traditionalist and as someone who is a wrestling purist to some degree, that's the package right there that stays with me, you know, from a memory standpoint. So let's talk a little bit about the history of, you know, the Undertaker and a little bit of his background. Before we get there and do that, I want to ask you guys this. Do you guys remember what he would do, what Undertaker would do after he defeated an opponent?
I'm trying to remember. Did it have something to do with the body bag originally?
Yep. It absolutely did.
He didn't do that a ton though, right? Like,
no, he didn't. But that was sort of one of the beginnings of the gimmick, is he would put his opponents that he would defeat into a body bag and drag him out of the ring. So,
yeah.
You know, again, they're playing the character to a full hilt at this point. And it really, you know, it really created the phenomenal character that so many of us grew to love very quickly. His first major feud was with Jimmy Superfly Snuka.
Yes.
Vic, you alluded to WrestleMania 7. But prior to that, it was basically just a lot of appearances in victory, you know, victory after victory. He participated in the 1991 Royal Rumble, which was eventually won by Hulk Hogan, but picks up his first feud with Superfly Jimmy Snuka. Vic, you seem to have fond memories or thoughts around that event. Talk a little bit about what you remember.
Well, the thing that they do so well is they group characters together. I know that sounds weird saying Jimmy Snuka is anything like The Undertaker, but they were both kind of like just like otherworldly, if that makes any sense. The way Jimmy Snuka, like, yeah, he was this big dude who jumped around a lot, but like when he talked, it was cryptic and, you know, mystical and, you know, it was kind of like he was, you know, in his own world or like an alien or something like that. And that was always the thing, like, you know, you were always a little bit kind of creeped out by Snuka. Like, you know, he was a hero, but still, like, you know, if he was standing around you, it was like, there's that guy. And they put him against The Undertaker, who, you know, I think the whole feud just ended up being making The Undertaker like the king of creepy. It's like, this is the new kid on the block. This is the new creep. And he is going to rock your world. I think that's what that feud really did for The Undertaker. Jimmy Snuka, I mean, another reason why I love that match is Jimmy Snuka is an incredible wrestler. So, you know, anytime you get to watch your heroes in the ring, I think it's big. But then, you know, it also showcased The Undertaker's style, you know, the original Undertaker style, which I recently found out he wasn't a huge fan of that. And that's why we started seeing like the American Badass, but we can get there later. But I learned that recently and it blew my mind. But he wasn't a big fan of the, you know, the really pro wrestling style that he had instead of, you know, like a wrestling style. And I can understand that, but as a kid, I ate that up. So.
Yeah. George, when, you know, when we look back at the history of someone like The Undertaker, we got to go back to when he began. He debuts in 1984 as Mean Mark Calloway for WCW. George, do you have any recollection or any you know, even if it's just going back and watching stuff of his days as Mean Mark Callis, you know, during his time in WCW?
So quick little, you know, I can definitely talk about that, but I got to say, like, going back to that quick Jimmy Snuka versus Undertaker, watch the Tombstone Piledriver at the end of the match. That has to be one of the nastiest Tombstone Piledrivers. And Jimmy Snuka is not a small guy. Like, the way he took it, like that was another key factor on how awesome this guy was and how pretty much, like, he made that Tombstone Piledriver, like, he made it look like he was about to kill a guy with that driver. So, yeah, just like if anybody listening get a chance, focus on that at the end of the match, and you will, you'll see what I'm talking about. So actually, something I read recently, and this is, you know, WCW, and it wasn't because, I think it was because of like one of those old WWE home videos, and they were talking about The Undertaker, but I had no idea Paul Heyman managed The Undertaker. I had no idea, and it was just one of those that blew my mind because, well, let me hold on, please. Paul E. Dangerously, go on to know him as Paul Heyman. But it was one of those, I had no idea that was. And it's just, you think about who Paul Heyman is now, and you think about what he led to ECW, and, you know, kind of like what if scenarios. And it's just one of those where to have a guy like him, and then Taker kind of matched up. I saw a couple of, pictures, and I was just, it kind of looked like if Stone Cold Steve Austin and Luke Gallows had a love child, that's what you're going to have in Mark Calloway. But as far as looks go, and I was just like, okay, that's not my Undertaker. But yeah, that was just like a quick little look around, and I was just like, huh, very interesting.
Yeah, he was a member of the Skyscrapers team in WCW as well. You know, very much due to his height and his appearance, he matched well as he replaced. At the time, Sid Vicious was legitimately injured, and so he became part of that team pretty quickly after debuting, after serving some time in WCW. He was first introduced as Mean Mark Callis, as we said, and basically was just a mid-carder. And from there, he was drafted into the Skyscrapers. And from there, you know, it was sort of this, I wouldn't say floundering within the world of WCW, but it's like anything else. There's a breadth of talent during that time frame that folks like himself kind of got lost in the shuffle as time went on. So he really finds himself moving around after WCW for a while. He goes to New Japan, and he was Punisher Dice Morgan. Can you believe that? He ultimately in 1990 signs with the WWF, now WWE. So seven years almost in the business before he even comes close to adapting what he's going to be known for 29 years later. You know, here, this is a guy who has now in total about a 35 to 36 year career. But, you know, these days we all know how many years it takes to really work in the business and get to a place where you are brought into the big league, such as the WWE. That's pretty much it right now until other groups come up. The point being that he put in quite a few years before even being considered and then brought into the WWF. One of the things that I know we all agree on is his ability to recreate himself is critical to his success. We saw the original Undertaker, which has a very distinctive look. If you look at the cover photo for this particular episode, you'll see that there's the original Undertaker image. And on the left side, there's the American Badass version. And of course, in the middle is the iconic black hat, black trench coat wearing Undertaker that we've all known for so long. Do you have any favorite renditions of this character that you guys felt like this was the time frame that I really, you know, stood out to you or, you know, was one of your favorites? Vic, we'll start with you.
I love, like I said, from the original up until he switched to the bat costume, that is it for me. I dressed up as that, and for Halloween
one
year,
which one?
The black trench coat with the, originally they were gray spats. They eventually turned to purple, and then he wore it once. I think again back to the gray. I think he was fighting the executioners. Who was he fighting? Shoot, I can't remember. But he went to that bat costume where they lowered him down, and then for one match back, he kind of reverted to the old Undertaker. Oh, it was versus Psycho Sid, for the title. But that's the one that does it for me. Me and my buddy Zebulon Dak, who's on Facebook, who might actually listen to this podcast, he was Paul Bearer and I was the Undertaker. And I mean, that was it. It was awful. And I'll see if I can find a picture. If I find a picture, I'll post it on the Three Dudes site. But yeah, that was the Jason Michael Myers character right there. But, you know, at the same time, he had this cool, like, gothic look to him, you know, very stoic. In some ways you could say poetic, and you know, just the way he would rise up every time, you know, every time he got knocked down, no matter how long it was, he would rise up. He wouldn't like roll up. He would rise up and stand up. Like he was just
right.
This hulking thing. And it was wonderful. It was way theatric at the beginning, especially way over the top, but how many more iconic moments can you remember? Like when, Jake Roberts slammed his hand in that coffin and he like beat up Paul Bearer. And then, you know, freaking Undertaker is chasing him up the ramp with one hand, you know, dragging a coffin behind a la Django. Oh God. And that song, okay. There's a song, Django, you drag your coffin around all over town like a dead man does. That's perfect. Sorry. Tangent, land the plane, that first run, gray and purple.
Yeah. All right. George, what about you? Any favorite renditions of The Undertaker?
I said it earlier. Contrary to Vix, I dug the whole Ministry of Darkness bat costume that he had. I don't know. To me, that was the perfect gimmick, perfect touches to everything. Everything from the very ominous entrance music, where, you know, it was kind of speaking in Latin at that point, you know, speaking in tongue. It was pretty cool. Like, you had that part, the whole lighting effect of, you know, just deep purple, and then everything's all black. You know, this is like around the same time as Raw's War, so as it is, the lighting, you know, the lighting was, you know, all black, so it kind of went well blending in with the Undertaker. The pyro was a lot more. They had the whole light strike here and there. The smoke was here and there. But, yeah, like, you really felt like this guy was coming after your soul. And, you know, this was at the same time as this was the same time that he's debuting all these different matches. You know, granted, it was not too long before that was the Buried Alive, the Hell in the Cell. You know, they go on to have the Inferno match. They go on to still have, the Casket match was also before that. But all these different types of matchups were around that time frame. And it's just, you know, it to me, that's where it's like this super force, you know, accompanied by all his minions, which I really believe that he was taking over their mind at the time. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm afraid of this guy, you know? Yeah, like this one, to me, that was the perfect time. Cause it was like, you really believe this guy was the true, heel at the time.
Yeah. Contrary to many people's opinions and such, I don't know why. I think it's because after having been a fan of the character for so long, I totally dug the fact that he completely recreated himself. But I was a big fan of the American Badass character. I'm probably in a small minority of people who think that way. But I remember being at the Royal Rumble in New Orleans in 2000, 2001 timeframe. And, you know, just really, really looking forward seeing how Rumble and always a favorite of mine since the beginning. And so, you know, if you ask me today over the course of my fandom, who's my favorite wrestler, it's hard for me not to say The Undertaker, because I've really enjoyed the different ways in which he's portrayed the character and the way he's evolved. And not everything was a success. I think a lot of people have written, and even he himself has said that the American Badass might've been a misstep, but it truly fit aspects of his personality that you definitely were able to accept who the character portrayals were. I was one that, you know, I loved getting lost in the whole supernatural aspects of the Undertaker. So when he became the American Badass, I was like, no, don't kill my Undertaker. And then I was like, wait, that's kind of cool. And was able to deal with it for the run that he did that with. But I'm not going to lie, when he goes back to that whole supernatural aspect and the blue lights come down, that I don't know what you guys think, but I get a chill, the gong and then the blue lighting. It just, it does something. And you get a sense that this is maybe one of the last times we'll see, at least in modern wrestling, the way in which a whole audience just buys in to this character. You know, we'll talk here in a bit about where we are today, but there's just something about the crowd reaction. Very few have even come close to touching it. I think, you know, Bray Wyatt got a little bit of that. But there's just something iconic about that gong and the dropping of the blue lights and the lightning that just, it sends a chill up and down my spine. Well, I want to say to this day, we'll talk about that in a minute, but in the overall sense of things, those were moments that like if I'm watching WrestleMania over the last several, you know, years, when it's time for his match, I sit up, you know, and I'm ready to go on a ride. A last ride, if you will.
Ha.
Oh, my goodness.
Stop.
Hey, so, I wanted to say real quick. I may have said something to demean the American Badass. I should say, in hindsight, at the time, I wasn't a huge fan, but it was still The Undertaker, and you better believe I was in front of the TV set when he was wrestling. I don't care what he looked like. As long as he called himself The Undertaker, he's okay by me. But seriously, I don't know if I read this or heard this, but it was a while back that one of the reasons why they did that character was to give him a chance to really flex his in-ring muscles. I kind of mentioned it when I was talking about, you know, the Undertaker that I like, you know, my favorite. He was really, you know, as far as wrestling goes, he wasn't great. You know, he was cool what he did. Like, everything was super iconic and super big and super dramatic. But that's the thing. It wasn't really wrestling. And I one of the reasons why he, you know, wanted to go that route was so that he could, you know, show people, you know, how this is how good I am. So looking back on it from that perspective, I have to respect the guy. And honestly, it's a huge, you're taking a huge chance making a creative jump like that. It may have not have completely worked, but it didn't tank the character. So good on him, for taking that chance. And honestly, good on him for wanting to really, you know, show a skill other than just his dramatic side.
Sure.
Good job, Mark.
George earlier brought up the fact that we have, through the course of Undertaker's career, we have been introduced to different matches or new matches. I think of the Inferno match that was mentioned. George also brought up the Buried Alive match, the casket match. And I got to tell you guys, if I'm honest, each of those matches, while gimmicky, yes, and with entertaining aspects, yes, I just never could really get into, like, the whole Buried Alive thing. You're taking me out of, you know, here's the guy who just said I totally bought him as a dead man spirit, you know, I'm sorry, not spiritual, but what's the word, supernatural character. Yeah. But then you put in the element of, oh, he's going to be buried alive, and I'm like, okay, I'll check out, because you can't really kill someone. And then people are like, well, yeah, but he's dead. And I'm like, damn it, don't kill my argument. because he would end up losing those matches, you know? The Inferno match, clunky as all get out. Like, you just, you know, you sat there watching going, they're not going to put anybody on fire. Okay,
and
maybe
then it was
foot. Yeah, okay, cool, got it. But there's limits, right?
Yeah.
So then I say all that to say this. We get one of the most awesome matches that,
yes,
I think from a legacy standpoint, The Undertaker has brought to us. And
yes,
maybe people in the back were the ones who brought it up or made it up. I don't care. It's The Undertaker's match. I'm going to say it because I don't say it often, and forgive me, but fucking Hell in a Cell.
Seriously?
I love that match.
Oh,
so many iconic moments. But when you think back to the first one, I still get chills when I think of what it was like when I first saw them enter that structure. And what a great legacy that The Undertaker has given us with Hell in a Cell. Guys, your thoughts on that? George, we'll start with you. Hell in a Cell, man.
Yeah.
What does it mean to us from a historical standpoint and just, you know, in its connection to The Undertaker?
Yeah, no doubt. Just going to throw this in there. My favorite match, or my favorite gimmicks, were the Hell in a Cell and the casket match. Just throwing that, fight me, whatever. Yeah, you look at the Hell in a Cell, you know, you compare that to the just the regular steel cage match. That's honestly what they were talking about. I remember specifically hearing those up till that time frame where they were like, oh, we're going to introduce the Hell in a Cell. And they were pretty much talking up, saying this is going to be bigger than the steel cage match. And you just, you're like thinking, oh, well, this can't be bigger than the steel cage match because the steel cage match is already wrapping around the ring. No, did they blow that out of the water? Like, pretty much, it's, you know, super high. It's surrounding the ring, you know, enough where, you know, grown men can walk around the ring and then touch the exit or touch the walls of the Hell in a Cell. But, yeah, just like you, I remember seeing it and I was like, what are they going to do? Like, what are they going to do? How are they going to top it? Little do we know that that was going to be a really bloody Shawn Michaels match. When it was Undertaker versus Shawn Michaels. And yeah, like Shawn Michaels bled all over the place. I could still vividly remember one of the promotional packages that they had. And this was WWF home video, not WWE, because WWE is not PG. But WWF home video, and it was Undertaker ramming Shawn Michaels into the Hell in a Cell face first, and then you just see Shawn Michaels grab and clench the cage and you just fall from there. But I just remember that, and it's just one of those where it's like, that's where you really got the true feel of how hardcore, how dangerous, how you truly believed that how Undertaker was this demon where only he could think of the worst things to do. Shawn Michaels being Shawn Michaels, of course, awesome seller, made Undertaker, you know, look that much more better. But, you know, it's just one of those, I remember seeing that. Even going back as an adult, it's one of those, it's a cringe match. You know, we talk about we brought it up, the Mick Foley versus Undertaker Hell in a Cell. Go back and watch the Shawn Michaels Undertaker Hell in a Cell. You also get the debut of Kane. Which another crucial character to the Undertaker legacy. But it's one of those where that matchup, you don't believe it. You don't believe it at that time. This was not a normal match, especially by WWF standards.
Yeah, the structure itself so imposing. And to this day, I love Hell in a Cell matches. I can't wait for them to show up. I'm not too much of a fan of the fact that it's its own pay-per-view, but because you always wanted it to be sort of random. Before we get to your thoughts, Vic, I just want to share, for those who are listening in, if you have favorite Undertaker memories or thoughts based on what we're talking about tonight, go ahead and give us a call. Let us hear your thoughts, 657-383-1249. Once again, that's 657-383-1249. And chat with us a little bit. Tell us what you're thinking and tell us your memories about The Undertaker. Vic Vespa, Hell in a Cell, of course, I want to get your thoughts. But are there any other matches in addition to that that were brought to us by The Undertaker that were favorites of yours?
Well, I'll tell you, I was a fan of the initial casket matches The Undertaker did with Kamala, and I know Yokozuna was one of them, but I don't think he did any other. I think those were the first two.
Shawn Michaels.
Shawn Michaels. I'll tell you that the feud with Yokozuna, that was a thing for me. Although at the end of the casket match, I was very upset. Not like inconsolable, but you know, a little peeved. I love the way they did it. I love the way they did the casket match with Kamala, where he hammered the nails in. That was just, oh my God. And this was little kid me watching this. So, you know, you know, you're kind of in on the gag, but you're kind of not at the same time. And seeing him, you know, slam that lid on there and then start hammering it shut with those big nails. Whew. Blew my little 10-year-old mind. I think the casket match was pretty legit. It towards the end, I think it started getting a little bit, maybe stale. I don't know. I think once the curtain of kayfabe lifted, it kind of made it a little less, a little bit more gimmicky, I guess is the best way to put it.
Sure.
But yeah, definitely the casket match. Hell in a Cell, of course, the structure looks demonic. They've said it on every pay-per-view and that they are 100% right. It looks like a cage, and it's horrifying. And it's wonderful. And Hell in a Cell matches have been consistently good. Even when people aren't jumping off the top of those goddamn things. Seriously, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Do we like that it's red now?
What's that?
Do we like that it's a red cage now?
I don't mind.
Yeah, I don't know. I never thought about it really. It didn't. I guess I probably don't, since I didn't really notice it that much. But
well, that might make it a good thing. I know I wasn't a fan when I saw it. I was like, oh come on, why did you add color? But things change, so
still better than the
so. As we look at other aspects of The Undertaker, let's talk a little bit, guys, about feuds. Tons of feuds we can pull from, and we'll save the Shawn Michaels and Triple H ones for the latter part of this discussion. But in the course of The Undertaker's now, as a character, 29-year career going on 30, what were some of the iconic feuds that you guys remember fondly? And then we'll take Shawn Michaels and Triple H sort of separately of that, because what a series of matches. But were there any other feuds, guys, that, you know, stood out to you as part of his career that you guys really enjoyed, George? You know, any of this stood out to you?
Undertaker versus Undertaker.
Oh,
I remember,
man,
being so freaking confused and was like, what Undertaker do I root for? Oh yeah, the purple ones. Cause the copycat was the gray gloved one. But I just was like, how are they doing that? Like it's the same looking guy. Well, turns out it was his cousin. But it was one of those, like, I love that feud even so much, that, you know, you had the copycat feud of that being the Kane versus the imposter Kane many, many, many years later. But, with this one, I just remember looking at those matches and I was like, oh my God, how do you distinguish between both Undertakers? You know, they had the same maneuvers, they had the same moveset, they had the same walk, they had the same, everything was just identical. And then it wasn't until the final match, the Undertaker versus Undertaker, and, you know, that's it. You never saw the fake Undertaker again. But, yeah, like it sounds cheap and it's super gimmicky, you know, but it's perfect. I love the feud.
Yeah. It definitely fit in the wheelhouse of what the whole gimmick was all about. And not just because it was Undertaker versus Undertaker, but because you really maximized the whole supernatural aspect and story that was being told by that feud. So yeah, I totally get that completely. I don't know if it stands up today, but you know, you guys are talking about stuff and I'm like, I'm going to go back and watch that stuff again. Cause it's a lot of fun. Vic, what about you?
Man, that is such a interesting question. I talked about the Yokozuna feud earlier, and that was one of my favorites, especially at the time, man. I was so invested in that. I wanted him to beat Yokozuna so bad. And when he lost the Royal Rumble, man, it was crushing. I understand now, you know, injuries and whatnot. But, oh, man, very upset. And the ending with, you know, his spirit floating away and that kind of stuff. Like, that didn't even faze me. Like, go back and watch that today, and it's kind of ridiculous. But like back then, man, I was all invested. But I think the reason that that's not my favorite is because I never got the payoff. I never really got to see him beat Yokozuna. He did come back and beat him later, but it just wasn't the same. Like the feud just didn't feel as inspired as it was before he came back from the injury. So, that being said, $1 Million Corporation feud is also really good, but I gotta give it to Jake the Snake Roberts. And it may be because this was the Undertaker's first babyface run. And it's like now, you know, you could officially be like, yeah, I like him because he's the good guy, even though he's a satanic, nonstop lumbering kill machine. But man, also Jake the Snake Roberts, when he is a heel, he is so damn good. And I can go back today and look at it, you know, through those eyes and just swim around in just the fantastic, you know, promo skills that Robert has, the way he moved around the ring. You know, and it was still the no-sell Undertaker, you know, where he was just, again, this kill machine that just lumbered around the ring. So I think, God, there's so many. But I think if I had to say one, I'd go with Jake Roberts.
Yeah, that was a great feud as well. You guys might be hearing my cat Steve the Pirate in the background. He really wants to get in on the show. He wants to share that his favorite feud was really not a feud because, Stone Cold Steve Austin was always a longtime nemesis of The Undertaker. And they always met up in different ways from the Ministry of Darkness days when Stone Cold Steve Austin goes in to save a kidnapped Stephanie McMahon, iconic moment on Raw, to their various battles after Stone Cold Steve Austin finally won the WWE Championship. That's Steve's favorite confrontations with anything between Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Undertaker, which happened to be mine as well. So me and Steve the Pirate, dude, we're like on the same page here. So
is it because they're both named Steve?
That must be it. That must be it. In fact, I think later I'm going to see if he can stun me, and let's see if maybe that's what it is. We definitely will. Our friend Matt Barth out of the WrestleManiacs brings up a very important topic we should talk about, and that is the streak. The Undertaker's iconic streak of wins at WrestleMania. Guys, when did you guys sort of have the first inkling that this was something? And George, what was your thoughts initially about the streak, and then take us toward the end and let's hear everybody's thoughts on what did you think about the streak? Were you into it? And what did you feel when it finally came to a close?
So I didn't really get the feel of the streak until the Undertaker teaming with Matt Morgan match. Oh, not Matt Morgan, I'm sorry. Nathan something? God, that's a bad. That was a bad match. But I just remember the whole match. Undertaker was fighting. Fighting the whole match, and then that's when the other guy came in. If you give me a second, I can find it. And I just remember that ultimately Undertaker came, or his tag team partner came out mid-match, and that's where it's just like, that was stupid. But at the same time, you were worried about him losing to Mark Henry. And that's where it finally hit me. After that, you know, we had all the wins that Taker ended up taking, but it wasn't again where I was worried up until the whole Shawn Michaels Triple H came into the picture. That's where I was more like, oh my God, he's gonna lose the streak. And then when the one in 21 and went the one and the 21-1 finally hit, I was sad and I cried my heart out. I was glad nobody was around me during that time, and we can just take a moment of silence to really appreciate that.
before I get over to Vic, our friend Matt Barth, party on Barth, is also to point out that in the early years of the streak, the opponents were all sort of gimmicky villains. Jake Roberts, Giant Gonzalez, King Kong Bundy, of course. Diesel, Psycho Sid's in the mix, Kane, Big Boss Man takes us to 8-0. WrestleMania 17, I think, is the first time we start to see wrestlers that are sort of not necessarily, well, I mean, yeah, Triple H was a villain, but I'm saying we then get into, you know, it being wrestlers of note for the most part, you know, the Randy Ortons, Ric Flair, and so forth. And so, yeah, it's the streak is something that, you know, you can't separate from the legacy of The Undertaker. And Vic, in your experience, tell us a little bit about how the streak impacted you.
I think it was WrestleMania 13 when it was the WrestleMania where he beat Sid. And I think I mentioned that earlier. Didn't I mention that earlier? I don't know. I think that's where I remember them saying, and I could be mistaking matches, but I remember, I think it was Lawler said something about him being undefeated at WrestleMania, or do you think he'll remain undefeated at WrestleMania? Something about asking about him being undefeated at WrestleMania. And I think it was X7 when they actually, and this may be earlier, but that may be when they actually started calling it a streak.
It was around that time.
I remember. Yeah, if I remember correctly, that's when they started kind of playing it up. Like, I don't think this, and I've read some things on this through the years. None of this has been confirmed, but I kind of have to agree with it. I don't think it was something that they initially made the conscious decision to do. I think they realized maybe after like five, you know, hey, he's, why don't we just keep having him win at WrestleMania? He seems to be popular. You know, what if he sticks around for a while? We can, you know, really start to ride this out. I feel like it was something, you know, decided later in the career. And as they got to like the 10-year mark, you know, that's when they started, you know, really making a big deal about it. And it kind of paid off in the end. I guess it's hard to say. A lot of things with big ambition in wrestling seem to sometimes peter out. The gobbledygooker, for instance, comes immediately to mind. So I don't know. I think that the ending of the streak is rather controversial, whether you can say it really paid off, but I think you could say it paid off in the long run. The ending wasn't great, but it kept people invested in the characters even more to, you know, come back year after year to make sure we won at WrestleMania. Land the plane.
Well, and that's the thing. I think for myself, the streak was more about the opponents after a while. You know, once it became a thing, like you said, WrestleMania 17 is really when around that time that the streak itself was being recognized. You start to see that the quality of opponent is much more about who is it that earned the right this year to try to be the one to end the streak. You really get into that mode when it comes to WrestleMania 25, when Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker meet for the first time. I know you hate this line, Vic, but I was in the building, and it was a phenomenal match that it was great in the venue. And of course it was, you know, it stands on its own every time you watch it, or every time I watch it, I should say. And just a phenomenal match. It really began what I consider myself personally, this is just my opinion, a four match series, two with Shawn Michaels, two with Triple H, that really just, you know, I didn't want to see anybody else in the ring with The Undertaker at WrestleMania during that time frame. And maybe I didn't realize it at the moment, but I know that at the point of WrestleMania 26, I really wanted to see Shawn Michaels get another shot. And when it came time for Triple H to step up, as of course he would do, because I got to do one better than my buddy Shawn Michaels, I'm going to end the streak myself. 2 years in a row, you got to have those matches back to back. But there was one particular opponent that, for me, I think, had the absolute best, maybe not showing, but the best reaction to an entry by The Undertaker, and that is one CM Punk. Go back and watch that match. CM Punk is the last opponent in the streak in which The Undertaker won, but it's the moment right before, you know, that was the year that we lost Paul Bearer. There was an entire storyline, you know, built around that, which of course that's what WWE does. And he and Paul Heyman had stolen the urn. There was a storyline about getting The Undertaker to challenge, or, you know, to take the challenge of CM Punk. And CM Punk was at his villainous best throughout this entire buildup. CM Punk comes out. He's in the ring. There's just enough of a long pause. And if you go and watch it, I promise you, you'll appreciate it. The bell or the gong sounds and the visceral roar that comes out of CM Punk as he's just so ready for this. It's not fear. It's not, you know, there's nothing. He's not playing this up as, you know, and he shouldn't. It was the perfect choice. He just lets out this visceral, yeah, because he knows what's coming for him. And they proceed to have a very, very good match. And one that for me, having gone back over the last few years and gone through all of the matches of the streak, because once it ended, I'm like, I got to go back and watch all this. To me, that it was just one of the, probably for me, the best moment of all. I really, really enjoyed CM Punk's complete selling of the entrance, and then of course everything that followed. So the streak is something that I don't agree that it had to come to an end. I get it. There's a lot that's been written and said about why, you know, Brock Lesnar was given that, and of course I don't think any decision to end the streak was going to be absent of The Undertaker. I'm sure he was in on the decision. And so history is what it is, and we have, I think, an intact museum of matches that the streak encompassed that cannot be in any way denied as being awesome. I'm going to go to the line and see who we've got calling in. Welcome to the Three Dudes of Doom. Who are we talking to?
This would be the one and only, live from Tampa, Florida, Vince F. Hannity, Esquire.
My goodness. My goodness. Vince Hannity, thank you, and welcome to the Three Dudes of Doom once again, actually.
Great to be back. Thank you for having me, and thank you for taking my call.
Indeed. So we're talking about The Undertaker, and I think you've got some thoughts. What do you got for us?
I might have a thought or two here or there. How much time do I actually have? Are we prepared for an epic 2-hour podcast, or do I need to edit myself ever so slightly?
Why don't we do the edited version, and we'll have you back later again.
Fair enough. And I'm sure you gentlemen have covered quite a bit of this. No one can or should deny that The Undertaker is far and away the most successful, the most money-making gimmick in the history of the business itself. Whether you look at Gorgeous George, whether you look at Hulk Hogan, whether you look at Stone Cold Steve Austin, far and away, Undertaker is the gimmick and the standard by which all gimmicks, now and forevermore, will be judged. That said, there's always a time where sometimes you can stay too long at the table and eat too much. And you were talking just not too long ago about the incredible history and the incredible catalog of matches we've had from this man, particularly at WrestleMania, whether you look at Randy Orton, the first match with Triple H in 2001 in Houston, the match against Edge in Orlando, the actually very underrated match that I view against Batista, which I think was in Detroit in 2007, on and on and on. That said, I am, you know, I'm not basically surprising anyone when I say he lost his mystique when he lost the streak. They made mistakes when they had him go over Bray Wyatt, and after, with Roman Reigns beating him the second time in Orlando, he just said, you know what, I'm done. It was a wonderful career, but he's kind of done what we've seen with folks like Ric Flair and other folks do. He's been at the table too long, and he's just eating a little too much, and it's not a good look for him. Now, mind you, like guys like Flair, it's one of those things where this is all he knows how to do. He's not exactly a guy that's going to go be a Walmart greeter or go, you know, there's not going to be an Undertaker Financial or anything like that, or the Undertaker, you know, Smokeless Grill or what have you. But I get that this is all that he knows how to do, but it's time to say, you know what? It's time to just ride off in the sunset, be a dad to my kids that I've got with Michelle, and not piss away my legacy any further, because that's all he's really been kind of doing the past couple of years, and it makes me sad.
Yeah. No, it's hardly an, you know, you're hardly alone in that thought. I know myself, one of the things that troubles me about The Undertaker, as much as I love his career, is exactly what you're talking about. We're left with what is someone who's holding on. You know, I couldn't even bring myself to watch the Goldberg match here just a couple weeks ago, and having read the material after, it's, I can't bring myself to watch it because, you know, it's just not there. And there is a match where you just don't have it in both guys. And so, yeah, I totally get what you're saying. In fact, you know, the iconic image of the coat and the hat at the end of WrestleMania 33, I believe, or whatever
yeah,
it was that he lost,
I think you're right.
Reigns. Yeah. What a perfect visual, you know? Yeah, I'm with you on that, Vince. I it's disappointing to see the path that he's on right now. And I don't know. I don't know about you, but I don't think I ever expected that from The Undertaker.
I mean, I don't know if I ever expected it. And you mentioned the Goldberg match. Here's the screwed up thing. As long as we're talking iconic matches, June 1998, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Hell in a Cell. Mick Foley knocks himself silly and mm-hmm. basically makes his career getting back up. But people forget, who's the person who helped carry him through that match? The Undertaker.
Yeah.
And seeing how sloppy he got and basically knocking Bill Goldberg silly, it's just another stain on his legacy, man. It makes me sad as a fan.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. The tag match that he and Kane had with Shawn Michaels and Triple H, of course, was more for, you know, nostalgia purposes. They've all admitted that that's kind of what was behind it, and of course, money. But if you go back and watch that
yeah.
match, you know, you can see very much all the things they've worked into the match to try to conceal as much as possible the moves that can't be done anymore by the Undertaker. I mean, that he goes for his swan dive over the top rope, and Triple H, I believe, is the one that hits him with a chair halfway through the move. And, you know, it looked vicious, but at the same time, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll take that, because I don't want him to take that leap. You know, I don't think he can.
I agree with you on that one. I don't think he can anymore either. But money aside, the idea of a nostalgia match, and I don't mean to put down other workers who do this on the reg, because mm-hmm. I go to these shows and respect it, but nostalgia match, that's indie stuff, man. We're talking about the one guy who, despite, you know, his early days, should never be an indie or a gimmick match or a nostalgia match. Keep the mystique. We talked about it with WrestleMania 33. He had up there with Ric Flair the night after WrestleMania 24. He had it up there with the Daniel Bryan ceremony on Raw.
Mm-hmm.
There are workers who would kill to have that type of a send-off, who will never get that type of a send-off. And just sadly, kind of like with Flair, he sadly kind of pissed it away, whether it's for money or for some other reason. Unfortunately, the end result was the same.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Vince, we appreciate you calling in. I got to ask you one last thing before we say goodbye. Favorite Undertaker match, feud, gimmick, part of his career, what stands out to you as your favorite Undertaker thing?
It's either one of three things, either completely destroying Jake the Snake Roberts at WrestleMania 8 in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
It may be having seen him live at WrestleMania 24, beating Edge for the World Heavyweight Championship in Orlando, because I was in the building, so that kind of helps.
I hate
heart.
You.
I love it.
And then, well, look at it this way. You didn't have to dodge fireworks debris, so don't, you know, at least you don't have to hit that stuff. And then bringing it up again, just a pleasant surprise of WrestleMania 23 in Detroit, that great match that he and Batista had when the year he won the Royal Rumble. So
Yeah.
Depending on what I've had for breakfast and what day of the week it is, one of those three moments, I think.
All fantastic moments.
I like it.
Vince Hannity, we always love having you on the Three Dudes of Doom. Thanks for the call, and we'll look forward to having you back somewhere down the road, buddy.
Gentlemen, thank you for everything. Three Dudes of Doom, now and forever. Thanks so much.
Woo! All right. Oh, show. Well, guys, as you can see, people are affected by The Undertaker, and we all have memories and such. Talk a little bit about what Vince just, talked about, guys, your thoughts on what we're seeing here in the last couple of years from The Undertaker. I'm not saying that it was different with Flair, because I felt like there was this notion of, great send-off, everything was done perfectly for him, and then I resented the fact that he, to use Vince's phrase, pissed it all away. What are we watching here with The Undertaker, Vic, and George? Should we be worried about the legacy?
Well, I thought it was funny how Vince phrased it all. Like, he started at the beginning talking about, how this impossible gimmick should have never gotten over, and it's the biggest thing in wrestling. And if you haven't started listening to Grilling with JR, his most recent podcast just happened to be about the Great American Bash 1990, where Mean Mark Callis fought Lex Luger. And apparently during the show or before the show, Ole Anderson, who was booking at the time, comes up to JR and of Mark Calloway says he will never draw. Can you believe that? That blew my mind when I heard that. That guy will never draw. He is wrestling today. And
yeah.
Vince was right. That there is no gimmick that has worked better than The Undertaker. None. As for the legacy, I don't want to agree with Vince, but he makes a very good argument that I've already made with myself in my head. And yes, I don't know if he should have immediately hung it up after Lesnar. I felt like there should have been maybe a return match with Lesnar where he goes over and they hug or something, and he calls it a day, or it leaves the coat and hat, on the apron, or, however he did it, or was it in the ring? I think it was in the ring.
It was in the ring.
Anyway, yeah. Sorry. Brain fart. But yeah, it does. I hate the Saudi Arabia shows. I just don't. From a human rights standpoint, that is really just feels wrong to me. And I can't imagine that guy needs to do anything for a payday at this point. I know he's like in real estate and, probably has a million charities and nonprofits. So it's like, I don't know why you would need the payday from wrestling. I think Vince is totally right. It does lose the mystique, and I hate that. But at the same time, I don't know if there is. I mean, if you like murdered someone on live TV, I guess I would probably have to say I'm not an Undertaker fan anymore. But I mean, if he keeps doing matches, we'll see what happens. But right now, I'm not ready to let go of that character, as one of my all-time favorites, because he was, along with Bret Hart, during that era. Like, I had friggin' magazines and everything. I was like I said, I dressed up like him for Halloween one year. I hope they don't screw it up. I think I feel like now, because they've done so much, if they go out right now, that would be a mistake. If they had one more like semi-epic match to go out on, I think that would be fine.
Yeah. Makes complete sense. George?
Yeah. So two things. WrestleMania 19 was what I was referring to a little bit ago, and then Eating Me Alive talked while everybody was talking. So I'm going to say it. WrestleMania 19, it was supposed to be Undertaker and Nathan Jones versus A-Train and God, I started, I already lost it. A-Train and Big Show. And that was, they built it up as Nathan Jones' big debut match. And, you know, why wouldn't it be built up? He was teaming with The Undertaker. But it ended up, you know, going bad for whatever reason. They pulled The Undertaker, or they pulled Nathan Jones. And it was just a whole match of Undertaker getting beaten up by the other two guys. So until Nathan Jones made the save, and the streak lived on, whatever, so on and so forth. But going on to The Undertaker's new matches, Sergio, I'm going to have to recommend you do not watch the last pay-per-view with Goldberg versus The Undertaker. If you want to have credibility to The Undertaker, please do not watch it. And it is one of those where, yeah, that match was, as, and I'll say this much, nostalgic, I'm 100% on board for Nostalgia X, up until they have to get in the ring. That's what I'm just like, do you really want to do that? You know, entrances from two of the most coolest entrances, you know, Goldberg and his pyro is like really awesome. I don't care what anybody says, fight me. And then you have The Undertaker, you know, we've had a whole show on The Undertaker. But it's just one of those, it's like really cool entrances. And then they get in the ring and then they start throwing punches. And I'm just like, I know where this is going to go. And it's not going good. So, yeah, I agree. If they have one more good match team put up, and, you know, dirt sheets are saying Undertaker versus Drew McIntyre. I don't know how true that is. Undertaker versus Sting. I don't know how true that is. But those are two guys. Yeah, I could see, like, the entrances being really cool. I could see Drew McIntyre doing all the work, making Undertaker look like, you know, the guy that he is, and then Undertaker hitting a couple power moves and winning it, calling it a day, taking the paycheck and leaving and retiring on his own. But will that happen? Probably not. But yeah, I'm on board with the Undertaker returning with his promos and his entrances, and that's where I'm done with him, with anything else with him. I just want to see that. That's it.
Yeah, it's looking more and more like SummerSlam will be a tag team match with The Undertaker and Roman Reigns taking on Shane and Drew McIntyre. Of course, that card's still to be booked in completion, so who knows what will happen between now and August. But, yeah, I think that if I could sit the man down, and with some sort of barrier between us, because I think he would be able to smash my head with his ham hock, as Roddy Piper called it.
Do it.
I would want to tell him, you know, you don't need to do this. You know, legacy aside, everything that he's done, everything that he's left in terms of memories and nostalgia and all of this great stuff, I worry about the man's body. I mean, he's risking, think back to, I forget the WrestleMania that it was, and I know I had it in my notes, I'm just trying to find it, where he took the dive over the top, and the cameraman, you know, slash wrestler that was supposed to break his fall, didn't. It was actually 25. It was WrestleMania 25 against Shawn Michaels. And, you know, yeah, the risk is there. He's the one that knows more than anybody else, you know, the risk that he signed on for. I'm afraid that those kinds of moments don't carry less risk anymore for a guy like him. I think he's at a point where his body, I don't know. I cringe when I see him, not because it looks horrible, but because I worry about whatever he has in the way of knee issues or anything else. All it's going to do is compound into something more dramatic is what I'm afraid of, which is why whenever I see that he's on a card, I'm very much less inclined to even want to watch it, because I want the mystique to be preserved. I want the image of what I grew to love about The Undertaker to be what stays with me. And that's why I like going and watching. I watched his entire series with Edge, the entire series of main events at pay-per-views the year that they were feuding. And my goodness, those were his heydays. That was when he could you know, you got to be able to keep up with a guy like Edge, and Edge will be the first to tell you, you got to keep up with a guy like The Undertaker. You know, here's a guy who, you know, his legacy isn't just to us as fans, but he has been the locker room leader for years. You know, I read Chris Jericho's book and others who talk about wrestler's court and how The Undertaker is the judge. He's the one that, you know, settles any sort of disputes amongst the wrestlers, or they go to him. I mean, the night of the Montreal Screwjob on Bret Hart, he's the one talking to Shawn Michaels and asking him, did you know? You know, and he has the right to do that because he's the caretaker of the locker room as much as, you know, the caretaker of his own career and image. And so, you know, there's just so many moments in which you can see how he loves the business and how he loves the people in it. You know, they do so much to protect his character that on the night of the Ric Flair retirement ceremony, his appearance happened off air. And yet he still took the time to walk out in his garb as The Undertaker and pay homage and respect to a man like Ric Flair. So, you know, The Undertaker is a caretaker of the industry. And I lament the fact that we're risking serious injury, in my opinion, every time I see him go out. And I wish I could talk to him and say, you got nothing left to prove, man. I don't know your business. I don't know why you're doing it. But I don't want the last image of my Undertaker to be him injured in a way that's permanent, you know? Not to get too heavy, but that's kind of where I stand, guys. I'm worried about what it's going to be like for him.
Yeah, I mean, the Tombstone pile driver, he's not good on the knees, brother.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's been his special move since the beginning. It's the same thing with the Stunner and Stone Cold, man. You think that helps his neck at all? Doubtful. That's what I worry about with Ember Moon, too. Oh, man, her finishing move is so dope, but it's a stunner off the top rope, girl. Careful with that. Like, I know. I'm not even a wrestler. I'm just a mark. Like, what do they care? But yeah, no, you got to worry about that too, because you don't, losing a legend is always difficult. And he was so, you know, he is so respected as a, you know,
oh yeah,
in front of the curtain and behind the curtain, like that BSK backstage, like there was the click and then there was like his BSK group, I think like Savio Vega and Rikishi, there was a few others a part of it, but that was like the crew that he rolled with, you know. I always thought that was just such an interesting thing, and the whole wrestler's court thing was, you know, that's legend, you know. Even I don't know if it's so much a legend backstage, but like, you know, to us marks, that's, you know, that is mythos of, you know, wrestling. Oh, yeah. So, you know, definitely best wishes to the guy. I, you know, he's like, he needs my respect or anything, but you know, entertained us for a long time and he put his heart and soul into it. He's honestly probably still is to some point. Yeah. I mean, I doubt, like I said before, this is probably not about money, or it can't be about money. I didn't say it's probably not about money. I just said it can't be about money. And I don't know at this point if it could be really considered ego, but maybe it is. Not that I'm calling anybody out. Again, I've not ever been involved in the business, just a mark. So take everything I say with a grain of salt, any wrestlers who are listening.
Yeah. Well, as we begin to wrap up our discussion here tonight on The Undertaker, George, any last thoughts or, you know, feelings about The Undertaker? What's he meant to you as a fan? Just kind of start to send us home with some final thoughts.
Yeah, no, he's irreplaceable, bottom line. There's not going to be another Undertaker. You said it at the beginning of the show. You have a guy like Bray Wyatt where he's barely going on the whole mystique and the real I guess, kayfabe and realism behind his character. But even at that, you know, he's still got some way to go. But honestly, you know, this Undertaker's nearly lasted, what, going on already 3 decades? Which, you know, by far, that's the longest anybody's gone consistently. And by consistently, I'm talking about, you know, 2-3 appearances at least each year. You know, but it's one of those where you're not going to have another Undertaker. You're not going to have anybody who, you know, guards the kayfabe like the way he did it the last couple of decades. You're not going to have anybody who, you know, who can pretty much have that streak, that can have that entrance, that can have that look to him. You know, you're going to have a bunch of guys that are going to come close to it and that could possibly pull it off, or that can do the game for at least a month and they get changed because of booking, but you're not going to have another Undertaker.
Indeed. Well put. Big Vespa, final thoughts for you on the Undertaker and what his career has meant.
I mean, it's everything. I think it ties wrestling together for me. Maybe I will stop watching wrestling once the Undertaker retires for good. Probably not, though.
Yeah, because we're doing a show, dude.
No. From the inception, I've loved the character. I loved him through his ups and downs. American Badass. Through great iconic music to crappy new metal. You know, I think the way he's been able to reinvent himself and the character throughout the years has been so great. I love that he brought the genre of horror into wrestling. I mean, he didn't bring it into wrestling, but he continued, I think, a trend of that disturbed, dark, dark character, and he just ratcheted it up to 11, because these go to 11. And I love it. I don't, obviously some of this later stuff is regretful, but if I have to go through some of that to get, you know, the fantastic stuff during his career, I honestly would probably trade that. I just hope he knows when to call it when. So
yeah,
that's what I think about Mark Calloway.
Indeed. For myself, it's a career that, of course, none of us tonight are saying that we're not going to make any decisions or have any impact on whether he ends his career soon. We certainly wish him the best. But for myself, all I know I focus on is what an amazing career this man has had. Mark Calloway has taken a gimmick that in the beginning people would have looked at and said, what? You're going to be an Undertaker. And I imagine his response might have been like, yeah, dude, you're not Kane yet. You're a dentist. And so he made that gimmick work in a way in which I don't think we'll ever see again. And that is the legacy that I think we're left with, is a guy who took what was given, maximized it, evolved it several times, and ended up being one who could call shots for himself in his own career. And when it's all written and the pen is put down, our hope is, of course, that he'll leave the business healthy and able to enjoy his family, because he certainly has earned the right to do that. I look forward to the day when we get to see him enshrined in the Hall of Fame. It is long past due. I frankly think he should be in the Hall already, even though he's still active. And I cannot wait until the guy starts to either write books or appear on videos more than he has already, because you can see him get interviewed out of character in the Monday Night War series on the network.
Mm-hmm.
But I want more of that. I want more of The Undertaker. I want more of Mark Calloway, because I just love what he's done with his life and his career. So to The Undertaker, we raise a mythical glass of whatever concoction supernaturally appears in our hands here in just a moment. And every time I hear that iconic gong, I got to tell you, I'll still get chills for the rest of my life. Guys, it's been a fantastic evening with the two of you once again, talking about The Undertaker. Thanks so much, as always, for being one of the three dudes of dooms, gentlemen.
Oh, yes!
I enjoy talking about my Undertaker with you.
And Paul Bearer makes an appearance. That was awesome. All right. Well, next week we'll be back with more. Until then, remember, get out, watch local wrestling, because it could be you that discovers the next big star. Thank you so much for joining us on this week's Three Dudes of Doom. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.